It's good to see everybody. Let me ask you a question. Why do people make bad choices? I know you've thought about that before. Everybody does. Parents ask this question about their children. Teachers ask this question about their students. If you're a boss, you've asked that question about your employees. And if you have a pulse, you've probably asked this question about yourself. Why is it people make bad choices? Before we look to the Bible for answers on this, it's interesting to note that modern science is also very interested in this question. One psychologist concluded that bad decisions are the results of acting on emotion rather than reason. And then to protect our ego, we double down on those bad decisions, even though it's obvious to us and everybody else that the decision was wrong. Another popular author says that we make bad decisions because we have a flawed ability to assess risk and reward. And then to compound the problem, this author says that the science seems to say that this flaw can't be fixed. It's a permanent feature of how our minds work. And then one more group of scientists believe that we don't even consciously make bad decisions. Instead, our bad decisions are the result of distorted perceptions. We just see things wrong. Subconscious mental processes like peer pressure or fear poison our judgment and cause us to make bad decisions. They also conclude that this lapse in judgment is, quote, unrelated to our intelligence, morals, or past behaviors. In fact, we don't even know it's happening, nor can we control it, end quote. I think it's interesting how all of these scientific perspectives agree that bad decisions are the result of natural processes that we cannot control and we cannot correct. And worst of all, the science concludes that we're usually unaware that our judgment is wrong and that we've even made a bad decision. This is one time where modern science is actually right in line with the Bible. Why do people make bad decisions? Or to ask this in a biblical way, why do people sin? Well, James chapter 1, verses 13 through 15 tell us exactly why everybody makes bad decisions. James 1, verses 13 through 15. Let no one say when he is tempted, I am tempted by God, for God cannot be tempted by evil, nor does he himself tempt anyone. So here's the root of the problem, verse 14. But each one is tempted when he is drawn away by his own desires and enticed. Then, when desire has conceived, it gives birth to sin. And sin, when it is full grown, brings forth death. So according to the inspired word, why is it that people make bad decisions? Every temptation and every sin is rooted in my personal desires. These human desires are the source of temptation that inevitably lead to sin, lead to these bad decisions. In the Bible, this problem is given a name. It's called the flesh, and that's the title of my lesson today. Or in some translations, you might see it called the sinful nature. So in the Bible, the literal translation really is the flesh, referring to our physical bodies and the natural desires of the human body. And so rather than calling the flesh the sinful nature, I prefer to call it the human nature, because I think that's more accurate. Paul said in Ephesians 2, verse 3, we all once conducted ourselves in the lusts of our flesh, fulfilling the desires of the flesh and of the mind, and were by nature children of wrath, just as the others. It's important to notice what Paul is saying here. Sinning is natural. That's why I prefer to call this the human nature and not the sinful nature. The natural human condition, unmodified by God, is an endless cycle of lust and sin. If we're being honest with ourselves, I think we know this is true. If we act purely by our human instincts, it will be an endless cycle of lust and sin. And so these natural human desires, which I think are God-given desires, get out of control and lead to sin. And again, that's why I think it's better to call this the human nature rather than the sinful nature. Because where did my nature come from? It came from God. And when God created it, it was good. So to give you a few examples of what goes wrong with the human nature, it is perfectly natural to seek self-gratification. Is that in and of itself a sin? Is it wrong to seek pleasure? No. But that desire, the natural God-given desire to seek self-gratification and to seek pleasure, to seek enjoyment, that desire is the very desire that leads to sins like fornication, adultery, pornography, and basically every other sexual sin and addiction. It's perfectly natural to seek a sense of self-worth and purpose. Now, is that wrong in and of itself to seek a sense of self-worth and purpose? I don't think so. That's not wrong. That's not a sin. But that desire gets out of control. And that desire for purpose and self-worth is what leads to pride, covetousness, and every other form of bias and prejudice. Another example, it's perfectly natural to seek self-preservation. In other words, it's perfectly natural, and I think it's a God-given desire to want to be alive, to protect yourself. But that very desire is what gets out of control and leads us to lie, cheat, steal, and kill. And so all of these natural God-given desires multiply outside of their God-given boundaries, and they lead to sin. It's these desires that get exploited by Satan and trap us in this cycle of lust and sin. I like to compare it to cancer. The flesh is like a cancer that grows uncontrollably outside of those God-given boundaries, invading every other aspect of living and thinking. The flesh starts to interfere with the other essential aspects of the mind, and then eventually, if left untreated, this flesh leads to our own death. Let me ask you a question. Does the average person just dabble in sin, or are they drowning in sin? You know, I used to think that the average person who was not a Christian, you know, was capable of being a pretty good person that, you know, just dabbled in sin. I'm sorry to tell you, I don't think that's true. I think the average person who is not changed by God is not just dabbling in sin. They're drowning in sin. And they may be very, very good at disguising it, but they are drowning. These examples of how the human nature, the flesh, grab us and control us are endless. But just consider the first sin in the Bible. Eve sinned because of her natural, God-given fleshly desires. God created Adam and Eve good, but those good desires were exploited by Satan. Genesis chapter 3, verse 6. So when the woman saw that the tree was good for food, that it was pleasant to the eyes, and a tree desirable to make one wise, she took of its fruit and ate it. You see, all of these desires existed before she sinned. These desires existed before she took of the tree of knowledge and good and evil. Eve could see that the fruit was good for food. Now, is that always wrong to see good food and appreciate it? No, that's not always wrong. Because the desire to eat is natural. That was a natural desire. Eve could see that the fruit looked good to the eyes. Is that wrong to appreciate beauty? No. The appreciation of beauty is perfectly natural and I think a God-given desire. Eve could see that the fruit would make her wise. Is it wrong to want to be wise? No, I think that's a natural process. So what is the problem then? What is the problem? The problem is carelessly following the desires of the flesh is not a path that leads to God. Even though God gives us these desires, if we only follow those desires, it does not lead to God. And so Paul says in Romans chapter 8, verses 7 and 8, because the carnal mind is enmity against God, for it is not subject to the laws of God, nor indeed can be. So then, those who are in the flesh cannot please God. In the flesh, if we're only controlled and pursuing those human desires, we will not please God. But fortunately, people are more than just the flesh. The fleshly nature is not the only force at work in the human mind. In addition to giving us these human desires, God also gave us a conscience. He gave us a natural sense of right and wrong, a God-given awareness of morality and eternity. And so Paul says in Romans chapter 2, verses 14 and 15, the Gentiles who do not have the law, talking about the written law, like the law of Moses, the Gentiles who do not have the law, by nature do the things in the law. These, although not having the law, the written law, are a law to themselves, who show the work of the law written in their hearts, their conscience also bearing witness. And so the flesh is natural, but the conscience is also natural from God. The conscience, Paul says, is the law written on the human hearts. The conscience is what compels every person to do what's right and avoid what's wrong. The conscience is the part of the human mind that sees God and knows God and wants to please God. And God put that in all of us. The righteous desires of the conscience are at war with the desires of the flesh. This is exactly what Paul says in Romans chapter 7, verse 18. For I know that in me, that is in my flesh, nothing good dwells. In other words, those fleshly desires will not lead us down a path of righteousness. Paul says, for to will is present with me. That means in his flesh. But how to perform what is good, I do not find. For the good that I will to do, I do not do, and the evil that I will not to do, that I practice. So the mind, the conscience, wills to do good, but the flesh wills to do evil. The mind, or the conscience, wills to satisfy God, but the flesh wills to satisfy itself. A familiar story on this kind of demonstrates the conflict between the flesh and the mind, the will of the flesh and the will of the mind. Let me read you the story, you'll recognize it. Matthew chapter 26, starting in verse 38. Then Jesus said to them, my soul is exceedingly sorrowful, even to death. Stay here and watch with me. He went a little farther and fell on his face and prayed, saying, O, my Father, if it is possible, let this cup pass from me. Nevertheless, not as I will, but as you will. Then he came to the disciples and found them asleep and said to Peter, what? Could you not watch with me 1 hour? Watch and pray, lest you enter into temptation. And then you know what Jesus says next? The spirit indeed is willing, but the flesh is weak. And in this verse, the spirit refers to the mind or the conscience. And this is a picture of the struggle that every person experiences. The conscience says to stay awake, but the flesh says to go to sleep. The conscience says to trust in the Lord, but the flesh says to be afraid. The conscience says to stand for what's right. The flesh says, just run. This is the struggle that we all experience. And so Paul concludes in Romans chapter 7, verse 25, so then, with the mind, I myself serve the law of God, but with the flesh, the law of sin. Here's the problem. The flesh always, eventually, wins. The will of the flesh is stronger than the will of the conscience. Why do we fail when we're battling temptation? Because the flesh is stronger than the conscience. The will of the flesh is stronger than the will of the mind. The will of the human mind cannot defeat the desires of the flesh. Paul says in Romans chapter 7, verses 22 through 24, I delight in the law of God according to the inward man, but I see another law in my members, that's the flesh, warring against the law of my mind, warring against the conscience. Paul says, bringing me into captivity to the law of sin which is in my members. A wretched man that I am, who will deliver me from this body of death? The flesh is the problem. Just like James said, Every sin and temptation we experience is ultimately rooted in our own body, our own human fleshly desires. And the conclusion I see in the Bible is that the flesh always wins. And what's worse is the conscience eventually dies. This is the story of every human being. The conscience can become so damaged that it no longer has a meaningful influence on our decision making. I do think every person is born with a healthy, God-given conscience implanted in us by God so that we know God and desire God and know the difference between right and wrong. But the Bible teaches that God lets that conscience die. Paul uses the Gentiles as an example of this in Romans chapter 1. Let me just read a few passages on this. Romans chapter 1, verse 21. Although they knew God, there's their conscience. Although they knew God, they did not glorify Him as God, nor were thankful, but became futile in their thoughts, and their foolish hearts were darkened. So they were in a good place, and then the conscience died. Romans chapter 1, verse 24. Therefore God also gave them up to uncleanness in the lust of their hearts to dishonor their bodies among themselves. Same thought. God eventually lets the conscience die. Romans chapter 1, verse 26. God gave them up to vile passions. And then finally, Romans chapter 1, verse 28. Even as they did not like to retain God in their knowledge, God gave them over to a debased mind. So the desire for God is natural. The desires of the flesh are also natural. Slowly but surely, inevitably, the desires of the flesh win. The conscience gets broken. And so Paul says in Titus chapter 1, to the pure, all things are pure. But to those who are defiled and unbelieving, nothing is pure. But even their mind and conscience are defiled. They profess to know God, but in works they deny Him, being abominable, disobedient, and disqualified for every good work. So the same Creator who gave us the flesh and gave us the conscience also gives us the solution. There is a way out. What I want us to see in this lesson is that sinning is just as natural as can be. God gave us a conscience as well, that constant reminder to defeat those temptations and serve God. But we cannot and will not do it on our own. And so God gives us a solution. You can be free from this sinful nature, this sinful flesh, but it comes at a cost. It comes at a price that nobody wants to pay. You have to die. There's no other way. You have to die. How does a physician cure a person of cancer? You know, it's different than other medical conditions. If you break a bone, what's the doctor do? They put it back together. If you have a heart attack, you open up the diseased vessel and you fix it. You don't fix cancer. What do you have to do to beat cancer? You cure cancer by killing it. Now, what is that cancer? You know, cancer is not like other diseases. Cancer is not like an infection. An infection is something that originates from outside of your body, gets into your body, and multiplies out of control. That's not what cancer is. Cancer is you. Cancer is your own cells that multiply out of control, and eventually they will kill you too. The only way to cure yourself of this cancer is to kill it. To cure cancer, a part of that person has to die, and so it is with Christ. If you want to defeat the desires of your flesh, a part of you has to die. Galatians chapter 5, verse 24, all those who are Christ have crucified the flesh with its passions and desires. And the Bible tells us exactly when and how we can participate in that process and crucify the flesh. Romans chapter 6, verses 4 through 6. Therefore we were buried with Him through baptism into death. that just as Christ was raised from the dead by the glory of the Father, even so we also should walk in newness of life. For if we have been united together in the likeness of his death, see, we're participating in that death, certainly also we shall be in the likeness of his resurrection. Knowing this, here's where he makes the point, that our old man was crucified with him, that the body of sin might be done away, that we should no longer be slaves of sin. So when we make that choice to participate in baptism into Christ, the flesh dies with Christ. And we might say it begins to die. He says our old man is crucified. He says the body of sin is done away with. Another picture of this process is over in Colossians chapter 2, verses 11 through 13. Colossians 2, verses 11 through 13, Paul says, "In him you are also circumcised with the circumcision made without hands, by putting off the body of the sins of the flesh, by the circumcision of Christ." Well, what is that? When does that happen? Verse 12, "Buried with him in baptism, in which you also were raised with him through faith in the working of God, who raised him from the dead. And you, being dead in your trespasses and the uncircumcision of your flesh, he has made alive together with him, having forgiven all your trespasses." So these verses together paint this picture. In baptism, we get to share in the death, burial, and resurrection of Jesus. In our baptism into Christ, our sins are forgiven, and the body of the sins of our flesh is cut off. We receive the Spirit, the conscience is healed, and that fleshly nature can start to die. And Paul also clarifies that this is only possible if we're baptized with faith in the operation of God. A person baptized without faith in God will go into the water dead in their sins, and they will come out of the water dead in their sins. And for that reason, baptism is not my work. It's God's work, where he restores the conscience, crucifies the flesh, and raises up a new person in the likeness of Jesus. That's the picture of our conversion. When part of us dies, our flesh dies, so we can be joined together in the likeness of Jesus Christ. That's my lesson for you today. I hope that is helpful to you. I find it extremely valuable to understand why it is people make bad decisions and why I personally make bad decisions. When I make a bad decision, it's because I'm letting the flesh win. And the only way to fix that is to kill the flesh through Jesus Christ. If you've never participated in that process, God invites you to let him conquer your flesh and join you to him through his Holy Spirit in the waters of baptism. If you need that or have something else the church here can help take care of, let that be known as we stand and sing.